Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is a repeat customer from last week. Tony is a poker player with some success, and we had a lot of questions for him. We didn't get them all, so he came back to visit us again. Tony, welcome back to Gambling with an Edge.
How you doing?
We're doing good. Do you have any experience with interesting prop bets, either personally involving you or involving good friends?
Well, I've seen a lot of prop bets over the years. I think that's part of the territory when you are a pro gambler. And you read online about these guys who are betting millions of dollars. And you have to wonder, on things like a bicycle race or something like that. It makes you wonder, are these things really happening? And I think for the most part, those things are very true. It's just the nature of gamblers. You know, we always want action. And, I had a good buddy of mine, and he had some really big tournament successes, and all of a sudden, it's when there wasn't a tournament going on, he just wants to bet on anything. He lost $40,000 on a game of darts, and he had never played darts before. I think they were playing cricket, and they didn't really understand how the scoring worked, so they decided on, I don't know, maybe $10 or $100 a point, thinking that it was like Chinese poker. Maybe someone loses $1,000. Well, at the end of the game, someone was down $40,000. And another time, they were playing shuffleboard. Never played shuffleboard either. And I want to say he lost over $100,000 in a game that he had never played before. And to me, I think that it's a little sad because, poker players are very competitive. And when you are, with your friends hanging out, you might propose a bet or do something, but once the betting starts, it becomes very cutthroat. And I've seen a lot of fights and arguments and a lot of friendships lost over very small bets. So for me, I've learned my lesson that when you bet with friends, you are also betting your friendship potentially. So if you bet, you really have to keep it small, because I've seen a lot of them that went bad. I had a bet with a friend over who would be stronger, who could lift more at these three different weightlifting things that we had decided. How much you could bench or squat or whatever. And the bet was for $10,000, and it took place over maybe 6 months, and it was very unhealthy, both for our friendship and also just physically, because we both started eating as much as possible to get as strong as possible. So I gained about 60 pounds. Jesus. And I was a lot stronger, but I was also really fat. And there's a great photo where we're sitting side by side at the all-you-can-eat buffet, 5 months in, and we're both just super fat.
Just eating all protein?
Just eating anything you could find, because the bigger you are, the more muscle you have. And, because we're not counting fat, we're not accounting for how much, relative to your body weight. It's just the overall. So, the stronger you are, the better chances you have to win. And we just really went overboard. And at the end, he ended up winning a really big tournament. So that $10,000 wasn't a lot of money to him. And I got injured very badly because I was just in the gym constantly. And we ended up settling. But, if it had come down to it, I feel like we're just so competitive that we could have, really ended up in some sort of argument. And so after that, I really try not to bet with friends. I don't even like things like credit card roulette. I had one in Atlantic City where I wanted a lobster sandwich going out with a group of 10, and they decided to get the tasting menu, but everyone has to do it. So, I don't want it. I ordered the tasting menu and a lobster sandwich, and just to be a sport, sat there. At the end, they wanted the credit card roulette it. And that's where, everyone puts a card in and, one person pays for it all. Turns out, I ended up paying for everyone's meal. It was, I want to say, close to $2,000. And all I wanted was a lobster sandwich. And the worst part is, with the tasting menu, it came with a cookbook. And so at the end, everyone gets a cookbook, including me. And a few of the people there saw I was really sour and had me autograph their cookbook. So just really insult to injury.
These are good friends. Yeah, when Richard and I make a bet, which hasn't happened very much, but we've made it $10, so that whatever happens to it, it's not going to screw up anything.
I'm more interested in the really crazy ones, like, you know, Huck Seed has made some just outrageous, you know, bets. One was that he could run a mile backwards in 8 minutes, you know, or play 4 rounds of golf in a day and break 100 all 4 times.
Right.
And the first time he tried, he missed it by...
Yeah, he shot a 101 on the first round and then ran the course 4 more times and did make it.
Wow.
But actually, along those lines, when you're talking about liking to be in action, you know, for Bob and I, in blackjack and video poker, having an edge, a definable edge, is everything. And poker players seem to just, they seem to be action junkies. Like, they don't seem to care about having an edge. You did, because you said you were competitive and really wanted to win the bet, but they'll often blow tons of money at sports betting or craps.
Absolutely. I think that I've known a lot of gamblers over the years, and that people just like to be in action. And I think that's a very dangerous a very dangerous attitude to have, especially when you're around temptation constantly. I had a lot of friends who, you know, they would play, and, you know, if the game got too tough, then, you know, they'd just take it to blackjack, or, you know, maybe they just wouldn't quit and, you know, continue to play poker. And those games like, you know, Party Poker, Blackjack, or I think now PokerStars has a online casino, and they have them on Bovada everywhere. They just really, they kind of prey on those emotions when you're stuck, when you're frustrated. And I think that the most important thing is to, you know, just know when to pack it up. And that's something that I think a lot of people, you know, don't get. They're hoping that the game will get better, or that, you know, maybe their luck will turn. But, you know, there's no point in stopping and starting arbitrarily, say, I've won this much, let's call it a day. But there is a very big point in saying, okay, these guys just bluffed me in the last 3 pots. They must really think I'm just steaming, or, you know, for whatever reason, they're playing really well against me. And, you know, most poker players, they don't bluff enough. So when everyone's taking shots at you, then you got to know, okay, it's like I must, you know, maybe I'm real disheveled or whatever. I played with a guy in L.A., very intelligent guy, and he was a professor. And when he would start to get steamed, that he would turn bright red, start sweating profusely, just everywhere. Just had a big handkerchief, and just start sweating and start playing every single hand. And, you know, when you saw that, you knew someone would say something like, lock the doors. And, you know, all of a sudden, no one would leave the game. No one could enter the game. And everyone would just play. He wasn't going anywhere. And, you know, being a very rational, you know, smart guy, when he was not on tilt, but when, you know, it came down to it, after losing a few big pots, he would just steam off like crazy. And I've seen that, but not usually where you can literally see the steam. He's just sweating profusely, and it's just a cloud of moisture around his head. So
we had this backgammon player back in the 70s at the Cavendish West in the Los Angeles area, and he was an Afghani player, and he would go on tilt regularly. In backgammon, there are bad beats every 5 minutes. And so if you're playing several hours, it's no big deal to get really bad set of things in a row, and it was dependable. He would be late in the session, would be totally on tilt, and just every day, because in backgammon, there's all kinds of opportunities to go to.
The craziest thing I've seen is there was a guy playing, one of my friends heads up, and they were playing limit hold'em, but pretty high stakes. And you know, as he would play all night, he would be drinking, he would disappear to the bathroom, and you know, he would be doing something in the bathroom. He'd come out with his nose twitching and full of energy, and they would play all night. And his wife and daughter one time came, and they begged him. They said, hey, he says, you got to stop. It's like, you've been here for all night. It's like, here's your daughter. It's like, look what you're doing. You should be ashamed of yourself. He's, you know, losing maybe $50,000 or $100,000 at this point. And he actually called security, and he had him thrown out. He said, get her out of here. And the wife started screaming and saying, what are you doing to our family, whatever. And he said, and get this bitch out of here. And I could not believe, I've never seen anything like that. But it's really a sickness. And I think that if, you know, they had any compassion, they would have thrown him out too, because here's an addicted gambler, you know, like tried and true. And it's just, you know, you see, you know, the good side, because, you know, everyone, when you win a tournament, when you win whatever, you know, everyone is, you know, happy, cheering, whatever. But there's also a very dark side too. And, you know, they don't film the guy who just lost his, you know, last dollar and, you know, is now walking home, or, you know, the woman who is crying. And so I think, you know, there's just very sad in a lot of ways.
You know, that's really a big part of why I gave up backgammon, because of dealing, not quite that bad, but certainly bad. And and if I was playing that guy, I would have had to quit. I realize that it's probably the most profitable situation you can have, but I don't think I could sit there while the guy's wife and daughter are there begging him to come home.
And that's something too that I think a lot of poker players, or maybe not all, you know, if you have a conscience and you wrestle with, you know, here's a guy who is losing his money and losing his mind at equal rates, and you know you're playing against him, and you have to think, okay, you know, should I be here? Is this right? You know, I'm profiting off someone else's misery, and I'm watching it, you know, right across the table. And you know, it's tough, because you know that, okay, if you quit, then they're just going to go play at the pit or, you know, the poker table. If you say, hey, maybe we should take a break, you know, when you're feeling better, let's play again. And you know, I've done that, and it's very tough to walk away, because you do know that the person is, you know, they're making a, you know, conscious decision to play of their, you know, own free will. And if you're not, you know, if you're not there to play, they're just going to go play someone else. So I think that that's something that people wrestle with. But I would say that if you are, you know, if you're in a situation, you're playing in a home game, whatever, and, you know, someone is just really, really having a bad time, really miserable, then, you know, money is, you know, it's a nice thing to have, and everyone likes to win. But I think that, you know, I don't know what you want to call it, your humanity should, you know, also enter in. At least you can feel good about yourself if you, you know, say, hey, let's take a break, you know, whatever. It's like, I'll play you later, stuff like that. You have to remember that there's a, you know, another person that you are playing against. And, you know, in the end too, I think you'll find that, you know, they will appreciate it too, if you give them action, but you're also respectful, and you know, there's no need to, I don't know what, skin the sheep, I guess. You can just shear it or whatever, but it's something to think about.
Yeah. Like you were saying about prop bets. You know, there was a period long, long time ago, way longer than the statute of limitations, where I had two friends who would call me and go, hey, do you know a bookie? I want to make bets on football. And I, you know, I knew these guys didn't know anything about gambling. So I would say, yeah, sure. And I would just book the bets myself. And, you know, they got in so deep, I realized that it was going to end the friendship. You know, that because they were going to end up owing me more money than they could pay. And fortunately, they kind of got lucky and won some of it back and were able to pay. And then the next season, I just said, oh, you know, my bookie's in jail. I don't have, you know, I just stopped taking their action. And yes, I know they ended up finding another bookie to take it, but at least it wasn't me. And it, preserve the friendship.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, you can always make more money, but I think that it's hard to find, you know, people who are, that you can trust, who are good friends and, you know, who have been there for you. So, especially if it comes to, you know, with your friends, like I said, I try to never prop bet with them.
One good thing about video poker is if I hit a $20,000 royal, the casino doesn't cry when it pays me. And, I mean, they can kick me out. But
I've been to some casinos where
they might cry.
Where they would.
All right. So let's change subjects totally. The UIGEA passed several years ago, which put a major cramp in online gambling. You said something, Tony, about you see similarities between the UIGEA and Bitcoin regulation. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think it's important to know what the UIGEA is. It's the Unlawful Internet Gaming Enforcement Act. And that was back in
October 2006.
I want to say 2006.
I'm not bitter about it still. Really, I'm not.
What day of the week? What was the date?
And the
11:30 at night.
That's right. The reason that they passed it, well, A, there was not a compelling reason to make it legal. And what I mean by that is that they had a lot of, donors, political donors, who wanted to see online gambling illegal. And those people are casino owners. Sheldon Adelson, I know, was a big proponent of the UIGEA, and the reason is he said that it's bad for families, you know, and it's afraid of minors. But it's kind of funny because, you know, like, it's somehow better if you actually have to walk in, you know, and lose the money face to face. I think that he just didn't want competition. And so the people that were lobbying on the other side were things like the Poker Players Association, and it's just, you really can't compare. The poker sites were making all that money, but they weren't, you know, they saw that the American market is important, but didn't realize maybe the effect that American politics could have on their overall profitability.
Or they were cheap.
Or,
and,
exactly.
You know, Sheldon's willing to spend a lot.
That's exactly it. He's a guy who wants to win, and he's got the money to back it. So what happened was that instead of regulating it like they could have done, they decided to make it illegal. And when I say illegal, I mean it's unlawful for them to – for a person to – it's not unlawful for the person to do it. It's unlawful for the site to offer gambling to the U.S. customers. It's unlawful for the transfers
of
money.
Yeah, the banks. The banks, right. And credit card companies were not allowed to transfer money.
And that's where they really focused, is that the transferring of money – but between the player and the poker site. And so this didn't take the act passed in 2006, but it didn't really kick into high gear until 2011, when they had Black Friday. They seized a lot of the poker site's domains. They froze a lot of the accounts, and they they issued indictments for a lot of the principals in a lot of these gaming sites. And the reason that – another reason that they really needed to do something about poker is that there's a big black hole of money. And, you know, if you've ever watched any sort of crime show or anything, they say this phrase, follow the money. And so before online gambling, that was pretty easy because there aren't a lot of very, very huge transfers. But because the sites were trying to avoid scrutiny, they made all these shell companies. So you might get a payment from 1-900-Flowers or, you know, Bikes R Us or something like that, and that would be your poker thing. And when they billed you from your credit card, they would have some sort of crazy name. It'd be like a closed company from Taiwan or something like that. And so because gambling is so big, it dwarfed all other kinds of process or money transfers through the entire banking system. It was billions and billions of dollars. Now it just creates a big pool where people can put the money in, and now be untracked, because if you are, you know, sending, say you are, I don't know, in Yemen or something, and now you're sending some money to for some terrorist organization in, you know, some operation in America or Great Britain or whatever, well, there's a million transactions like you now. There's no way to track that stuff. And that's really what they were looking at, is the, you know, the terrorism aspect, whatever. And, you know, it's difficult because, you know, as Americans, we believe in, you know, freedom and, you know, and also, you know, carrying cash as gamblers, you know, you don't want to be hassled when you're carrying large amounts of money. You know, it's not illegal to do it. But, you know, we also have to think that, okay, there is a real risk that, you know, it's all these things are happening under our nose. We should at least look at them. And so that's, I think, a big part of what happened. And when you look at Bitcoin, which is, you know, Bitcoin is really an amazing thing, especially for gambling. That's, I think, the biggest use of it, because you can make instantaneous transfers. They're not reversible, and you can pay out, you know, within seconds. Cash out fees, the processing fees are almost zero. And it's not like a credit card in any way. And there's no chargeback, so, you know, the merchants love it.
I thought that the processing fees had gotten expensive. I thought
they are getting more expensive, but you pay for the speed that you want it to be processed at. But I don't think that the fees will ever, at least right now, I don't think they'll ever exceed like 1% or 2%. You know, so, and it's lower than that, much lower than that. We're talking, you pay per transaction, not necessarily per as a percentage of your fee. So you might pay, you know, 50 cents or a dollar or 8 cents or whatever to process a transaction of $10 or $10,000.
And see, I had heard, I mean, yeah, it started out, they were really, really, really cheap. But I had heard that they, during the frenzy, that the fees had gotten up to $30 or $40 per transaction.
Yeah, I think that in some cases there was, you know, a backlog. Because it's all processed by computers. You get priority by assigning a higher fee to your transaction. So if you want it to happen immediately, if you don't want it to happen to get lost, then you would have to pay a higher fee. And that's something that, you know, as it's all denominated in Bitcoin. So when the price of Bitcoin gets very high, then the fee is higher too. And that's something that, you know, as the price is lower, there's less transactions taking place, then, you know, it is a lot lower. But, you know, relative to the price of Bitcoin is the key. And but I do see a lot of similarities, because there are a lot of legal uses for Bitcoin and there are a lot of illegal uses for Bitcoin. And so I think that, you know, you can track, because it's a ledger. So every single transaction is, there's a history of it on the internet of where that money went, where it was. And what you'll find is that a lot of the people who are using it for illegal methods, they have these ways where they can mix the coins to basically hide the provenance of their money. And so now they list addresses that they think are tied to crime. And they have a lot of stuff going on with where they have, you know, a cyber crimes unit or whatever. And so when you receive money, when you receive Bitcoin from one of these addresses, if you go to cash it out in exchange, they look at the blockchain, the history, and they might give you a hard time. They might want to know, where did you get this money? This was a, you know, this money was tied to some crime or something. So I think you're definitely going to see more and more regulation in the future, especially, you know, as they develop more and more tools to track what is going on. But I think it's something that's very difficult to stop once it's out. But it may just be that, you know, with a lot of the manipulation and fraud of the actual the Bitcoin itself, that it may just be something that fades away or is replaced by something which is, you know, new or, you know, better in some way. Because just because it was the first doesn't mean that it's, you know, going to be the final product. And something that is decentralized might not be the best. I mean, there's a lot of proponents for it, but, you know, some oversight is, you can see where there's pros and cons to both.
So are you in Bitcoin or not?
I was playing a lot online, doing a lot of online gambling. And when I did use Bitcoin very, very heavily, I don't think there's anything like it. Instead of receiving a check in your name, you receive, you know, coins in your account within an hour. And, but I think it's very speculative, and, you know, as a gambler, you're taking risks all the time, you know, and it doesn't make sense to be a gambler taking all these risks and then also, I feel, you know, have a very large amount of your money in another, you know, thing that you have no control over. A lot of people, they throw around numbers like, okay, the Bitcoin will go up 10% a month, 20% a month. It's going to double within a year. But these are just predictions. You know, no one really has any idea where it's going to go. So, you know, for there are people out there who keep 80, 90, 100% of their net worth in, you know, this coin. Well, I mean, you know, one day they could find out that, you know, it was a lot of it was propped up by certain exchanges or whatever, and the price could, you know, cut in half. It went down 80% at one point. So, you know, you really need to think very carefully about your risk tolerance if you have a lot.
Well, and the other thing is, there's too much money involved for the government not to get involved. And people say, well, but they can't. It's decentralized currency. But they could just outlaw it. I mean, and yes, you can meet someone in person and physically transfer Bitcoin to them and hand them cash to buy it. But if the government decides to control it, like that would be one way for you to transfer, just as we could meet and I could hand you a suitcase full of cash. But then what are you going to do with it? Like, at some point, you want to be able to spend some of it.
Right.
And then, so what I'm saying is, the people who are doing this because they think, oh, I can hide my money and avoid taxes, well, somewhere down the road, they may end up with a very big problem.
Right. And I think that's exactly it. You know, while it is, you know, it exists on the ledger and, you know, you have control of those coins, if the government tomorrow says, okay, Bitcoin is illegal, people say, well, they won't be able to touch my coins. But those coins will be a lot less valuable because there isn't going to be a place that you can go and change them into U.S. currency. The demand for it will be very low. And so, you know, people have to understand that the government does have a very, very big role in how they treat it. If they treat it as a commodity or a currency, or, you know, with some of these other coins that they offer, are these shares of stock or what? The regulation is going to be very important going forward as far as the price goes. If people don't want it, if, you know, it's illegal, then they will find that it's the price just goes, you know, way down. These institutions are not going to be able to hold these hedge funds, Wall Street, all the money that they're counting on. They're not going to be able to hold large amounts of it.
All right. We're talking to Tony. We're going to take a brief commercial break. When we get back, we have some interesting stories about going through airports with money and some of the problems with European strip clubs. The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. Throughout the rest of July, you may earn Chevron and or Walmart gift cards at 8,334 points earned and redeemed in July for a $50 gift card. Limit 10 for the month. The second week of free video poker classes, Tuesday, July 10th, the first class will be double bonus poker, and the second class will be double bonus poker. Now, they sound like they're the same game, but they're not. The double bonus poker pays 7-for-1 for the flush and 5-for-1 for the straight, whereas the double version is 6-for-1 for the flush and 4-for-1 for the straight. Those make significant and predictable strategic changes. So we're teaching both classes at the recreational level because the best games at the South Point are around 99%. However, they're both, some of the games we're going to teach later in the semester are based on the principles you learn. So if you're not familiar with how the strategy changes when the flush changes and the straight changes, it's a good class to sit in and pick that up. Also, compared to last week when we taught Jacks Are Better, two pair pays single money in these games rather than double money. That makes another systematic set of changes. And if you go from game to game, you need to know what these systematic changes are. Those players who play all games with more or less the same video poker strategy are not called winners. The game of the week at videopoker.com is the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the game. The game of the week is Good Times Pay. You can play this game 6 coins to 10 coins per line. They have random multipliers, but it's always 100% bonus. At South Point, the best game is quarter triple play, NSU deuces. This is a 99.7 game, whether you pay 5 coins per line, 6 coins, 7 coins, 8 coins, 9 coins, or 10 coins. The variance changes a bit. So the quarter triple play is $7.50 per line. The reason I play this game is it's nearby other machines that I want to play, and they're sometimes busy. So it is a NSU with a 0.3 club is an even game. So it's basically a good place to kill time while I wait for my machines to open up. Okay, we're back talking to Tony. Tony, you at least once went through an airport with lots of money. What happened?
That's right. I had a bad experience traveling through TSA out of St. Louis, actually. And I was going to Atlantic City to play some poker. And my method at the time, I think I was about 23, was to grab whatever was in my dresser or in my safe deposit box and just go to the casino. So I did. And so I went through TSA and they stopped me. And, you know, this was during a time of heightened security. They were looking, you know, on the lookout for, I don't know, terrorism, whatever. But just in general, they were just very cautious. And so when they found the money, they took me into a side room and they asked me, okay, well, how much money do you have? And so for me, I did not count how much money I had, and I couldn't even tell you to the $10,000 amount, how much money I had. Unfortunately, I just grabbed everything on my my dresser, and it might have been about $70,000. So I said, "Yeah, I really don't know. I couldn't guess." And so, you know, they were like, "Well, what do you
mean?
It might
be 40. It might be 80. Yeah, they're like somewhere in there about."
They're like, "What do you mean? You don't know? Is this your money?" I said, "Yeah, it's my money." And I said, "Well, let's get it out and look at it." So I'm like, you know, they get it out. I'm like, maybe it's 60,000, 70,000. And they really didn't like that answer. So they came out and they said, "Hey, Kate, well, are you carrying drugs?" And I said, "Well, you know, I've got no drugs, no." And they say, "Okay, well, what we're gonna do here is we're gonna take your bag, and we're going to pull it off the plane, and we are going to search it for drugs. And if there are any drugs in there, if the drug dog detects a hit, well, you're going to jail, and we're going to take all your money." And I said, "Okay, that's fine, but you know, you're not going to find any drugs." And I think my problem here was that, you know, I probably hadn't showered in a day or two. I was, you know, living the online poker lifestyle, and here I am, you know, walking through with a bunch of cash, don't know how much it is, and, you know, I say I'm going to New York.
And 23.
And I'm 23. And I just don't look like the kind of person who would, you know, have that much money. And so they're like, okay, well, they sat me in this interrogation room, and there's 4 of them there. And they sent me, I was there for a total of about 4 or 5 hours. And it was very, it was almost like out of a movie. They just took turns asking me the same questions over and over, and seeing if I would give a different response. And, you know, one guy.
Were these police at this point?
These were. So one was TSA, one was a supervisor, I think there. One was an actual detective, and one guy might have been from like the DEA or something. They called him in. And so one of the detectives, he would ask me all the questions. And then after every question, he would be like, "I don't believe you." And say, you know, what's your name? "My name's Tony." "I don't believe you." And it just became almost like, you know, a circus. And I kept smirking because I thought, okay, this is, you know, it's almost like a prank. And they just they really didn't like it. Yeah, I guess I didn't feel that they didn't feel I was being sincere or whatever.
Not taking it seriously
because, you know, it just seems like a, you know, like a cartoon. And what ended up happening is so they wanted to call all the places in Vegas that I played at. You know, I had a front money on deposit at the Bellagio, so we called them up. And of course, the Bellagio doesn't want to give any information over the phone. You know, if the guy says he's a cop, well, you know, the front cage is they're just not going to deal with that. You know, if a guy calls and says, "Hey, tell me about this player. How much money does he have in his account?" You know, they're just not going for it. So you know, all of a sudden that was, you know, more evidence of my guilt, and, you know, everything that I did or said was more evidence. And so, you know, after a while, and obviously I missed my flight too. We were just sitting there hours and hours, and finally someone comes in and they're like, oh, you can go. I said, well, okay, guys, I'm glad to be getting out of here, but what happened? And they said, well, we just Googled your name, and we saw that you are a poker player and you just won a bunch of money. So congratulations. Here you go.
And I bet you wish you had thought of that idea while you were sitting there.
I could have made my flight. But, you know, I realized then, and especially you read about this stuff in the news where these people are – they're getting hounded. They're getting their money taken by TSA, cops in the airport when they're carrying large amounts of cash. And I think that especially if you don't speak English that well, if you get nervous, if you seem suspicious – and keep in mind that anything could be suspicious. Having too clean a car, too messy a car, driving too fast, too slow, or just speed limit. They're all suspicious in a way that you know, at least, you know, through the right lens, that they'll just look for, you know, a reason to take your money. And so I feel, at least in my case, that they were really reaching, but I don't think they would have done anything without some sort of at least concrete you know, reason to, maybe if – but again, you just don't know what these people, you know, maybe they could have said they smelled some, you know, some marijuana or something like that. So I think you just have to be very, very careful when you're going through the airports. And one thing I learned is that when you have a large brick of cash that's bundled together, that it actually shows up on the scanner with a dollar sign. So, you know, if you are looking to, you know, transport some money or whatever, then it would be better to keep it in, you know, looser bundles and definitely not, you know, bundle it very tight with rubber bands. If you do, then, you know, keep it in a couple different spots, because once they see that, I mean, they're obligated, you know, that's a procedure to take a look at it. And it just, you know, it's never happened, at least in my experience, that the TSA officer has pulled me aside and said, you know, you're such a good, you know, you're such a good subject, we're going to give you first class tickets or anything like that. Only negative things can happen. So that would be my advice.
Yeah. Also, don't put the money in plastic bags, because that looks suspicious to them. And anecdotally, it seems that airports have gotten safer for carrying money, much safer than driving.
I would definitely agree.
A lot more cases of the police stealing the money, you know, from drivers than flying.
I would definitely agree with that. And I've had a couple experiences recently where I was traveling outside the country. And when I came back, you know, I declared my money. And afterwards, when TSA saw it, they all they wanted to do was they just took a picture of it, and they took a picture of my ID. And they really didn't give more than a second glance. And in the past, I know that it would have been, you know, an hour or two of like really serious scrutiny. So I think that I do feel very comfortable carrying the money in airports now. I think one thing is that if you carry casino chips, they often, if they're bundled up, they will set off the scanner as well, because there is some metal, or and it also looks, especially if you have a stack of them, like it could be something. So that's something to be careful of too. Don't like bundle them up, anything like that.
The last time I had to carry a large amount of money through an airport, I was coming home and I had dozens of straps of $5,000
bundles.
Bundles, $5,000 isn't a big one, but I had, you know, $80,000 or $90,000 worth. They all had the casino name on it. So I told them going through TSA, I said, I need to be examined in a private room. And then I went in there and I said, I did well in the casino. There's a lot of cash in my cargo pants pocket. There's also all the W-2Gs I want at that casino, and you can call them and verify it. But you're going to find a lot of money in there. And this is what happened. And then they looked at the W-2Gs and said, okay, you can make your flight. This looks reasonable. So just declaring it took some of the wind out of their sail, I think.
Well, I'm also a minority too. So, you know, one look at me.
I had a nephew who was not Caucasian, and he had a bulge in his pocket in the Phoenix airport. And it was only $7,000, but he missed his flight. they were there hounding him about why he had $7,000.
Yeah, I was 65 years old or so, and that didn't, so maybe it wasn't that unusual. I don't know.
That
but still,
makes
carrying
a big difference.
$80,000 in cash through an airport is, it's a bit suspicious. Yeah, if they want it to be.
That's exactly it.
Yeah.
All right, changing subjects. Strip clubs in Europe. They can be expensive propositions. Have you had any experience with this?
Well, I've had a few, believe it or not. And
is it true over there too that you've seen one, seen both?
When I was playing in Paris at the Aviation Club de France, which is now closed, and this was I was under 21 at the time, so maybe 14, 15 years ago. And after one night, we decided to go out to the red light district, which is called Pigalle. And some people had warned me about that place, but I'm not very good at listening. So me and a couple of my friends from Singapore decided to just go step out there, check out, you know, maybe a strip club, hang out, get a drink or something. And we ended up walking into what's called a clip joint. And I know you guys have had some out here in Vegas. But what it is, essentially, it's a place where it's designed to separate you from your money as quickly and as fraudulently as possible. So when we went in there, there's a place that had cover of, €5 comes with a drink. So we go in there, and when we go in there, there's no one doing anything. There's just a bunch of women sitting around. There's no one else in there. There's no one on stage. There's no music playing, and it should have been very, very suspicious to us at the start. But, you know, you're both all 19, so didn't really think much of it. Anyways, so they turn on the music, girl gets on stage, and they say, okay, hey, won't you buy us some drinks? There's three of us, and we say, okay, sure, I'll buy you a drink, and, you know, we get our free drink or whatever. And they immediately chug the drinks, like almost instantly, probably, you know, like 30 seconds or less. And they're pretty big drinks. And, you know, it was just like being at a fraternity party. And so I'm thinking, okay, it's a little unusual. They must have been really thirsty.
Well, those drinks are probably not full strength.
That's true. I said, they must have been really thirsty because why would they drink it so fast? And they say, hey, can we get another drink? So my friends, they say, oh, sure, no problem. And I say, well, wait a minute here. It says, how much is a drink for you guys? Because, you know, you seem to be a little pushy. And she's like, oh, well, hey, don't worry about it. No, it's not a big deal. So, you know, I get down to the menu and I'm looking here. And, you know, I see all the drinks for, you know, it says for, you know, men. Here's a drink list. But there's nothing for women. And so, you know, I'm looking very close and it's very dark. And, I see some fine print at the bottom. And so, you know, it's like I get out my flashlight. And she's like, oh, don't worry about it. Just, you know, have some fun, whatever, relax. So I get out my phone flashlight and I look at it. It says that the drinks, is the lady drinks, they're called, they are €200 a piece. So now we've ordered five drinks and we've been in there about probably less than 5 minutes overall. And so I'm like, okay, hey, we're just going to leave. You know, it's just pay our bill and get out of here. So we go up to the front and they say, okay, it'll be, it's like, you know, $3 for your drinks or whatever, €3 for your drinks. And it's like 1,000 or 1,200 euro for the lady drinks. And I said, well, you know, we've only been here 5 minutes and, you know, it's like the prices aren't clearly marked. And so I don't really feel this is fair. And then, you know, all of a sudden, you know, nobody speaks English anymore. And, you know, my French isn't that good. You know, I took 5 years, but it's okay. And so, you know, now we're speaking French. And all of a sudden, you know, no one understands a word that I'm saying. And these big guys come out of the shadows here and, you know, they want their money. And I say, okay, well, let me speak to the manager. No one cares. And so finally, you know, this other guy comes out and he's obviously Western or something. And I say, look, I said, you know, you guys got us real good here. I said, I'm a real poor student. You know, we've got no money here. You've just ruined our vacation, but I'll give you all, you know, €372, whatever I had in my wallet at the time, because I actually had a money belt with a really large amount of money on me at the time, just in case, you know. But, you know, I put just a little bit in my wallet and, you know, he looked at me and I was like, you know, hey, it's like, good job. You guys got us. You know, I wasn't mad. It's a little irritating and a little embarrassing, but, you know, I didn't argue at all. And he was like, okay, you guys could go. So he paid him €372 for 5 minutes of fun. And, we were on our way and, you know, I told some of my friends about that. And, a buddy of mine told me that he had he had a friend who was in London, and he was drinking champagne with the girl for hours, just talking. And at the end, they presented him with the bill for, I don't know, like 3,000 or 4,000 euro. And he said, okay, well, I'm not going to pay. That's, you know, that's ridiculous. And, you know, I think that's the wrong way to go about it. Obviously, you owe something, but like, you know, $4,000, that's their starting point. Now, these are all scams. But, you know, to say, hey, I'm not going to pay, well, that's not going to really go anywhere. Anyways, they beat him to an inch of his life. So you got to be really just really careful. He was real irate too and very belligerent. And
did he go to the police after he got beaten?
I don't think so. I think he went to the hospital actually, obviously. Wow. But, you know, I think after that he was just, you know, he really didn't want to like deal with it anymore. And it didn't seem like there was going to be anything good that came of it. My –
I've heard stories like this where the bill is 30,000 or 40,000.
Uh huh. Yeah. I had a poker player friend of mine, and story goes, he was in somewhere in Eastern Europe, and they went to the strip club, and they were talking about how great they are. They say, "Hey, I'm a big poker player. You know, it's like I've won all these things. It's like, look at my watch. I'm so rich." And, you know, they had a big group there, and they're just drinking champagne. They're just really going crazy, having a good time. They keep the club open two more hours after. And at the end of the night, they say, "Okay, well, we're here to settle our bill." And he says, "Okay, well, it's going to be like 38,000 euro. And he says, "What?" He says, "No, I looked at all the prices here." He's like, "Yeah, well," he's like, "you know, we kept the club open for you two extra hours." And he's like, "And you're very rich." He's like, "I know you're a successful guy." He says, everyone in this club knows. He says, "We know you can afford it." He says, "So it's 38,000 euro. And he says, "Well," he says, "I got 5,000 euro. But," he says, I'm not going to pay." He says, "That's not what the prices say." He's like, "Let's figure it out." And the guy says, well, "you got two options here." He says, "You can pay this 38,000 euro," he says, "or I'm going to kill you." And he says, "Well, okay."
That's funny. Yeah.
He's like, I choose option A. And they're just, you know, very big managing guys. And he says, "Okay, well, once you leave your rental car here," he says, we'll drive you back to your hotel. And we'll be waiting out there in the morning for you. And we can take you to the ATM or wherever you want to go," he says. And we'll go ahead and get that money. And so, you know, they went to the hotel and they spent a sleepless night wondering, "Oh, should we make a run for it? You know, whatever." In the end, they said, "You know what? We're just going to pay." And we just, you know, who knows? Those guys were waiting there in the morning. It took them like to the bank or something. And somehow, like, they got the money wired in and they paid them. So,
wow. My partner played in Sri Lanka.
Uh-huh.
And the limits were small at the time, and he only won, I think it was about $3,800. Huh. And he was, you know, young and stupid. This is at the time that there was a civil war going on, and the Tamil Tigers were the faction that was warring. And the Tamil Tigers are the terrorist organization that invented suicide bombing. Oof. So, Sri Lanka was not a great place to be at that time. Anyway, he won this $3,800, and because of the civil war, the casino had these guards that stood around with machine guns in the casino. Anyway, the casino owner invited him into his office and said, "This is a very dangerous game you're playing here, and if I were you, I would not ask to cash out those chips." And my friend said, no, I won. I want to cash out." He's like, "I think it would be a very bad idea for you to take this money." Anyway, my friend argued that, "No, I want to be paid." And he ended up getting paid and did not end up getting killed, which is kind of amazing. you know, were it to happen today, I think, you know, we all would have made a different decision.
He's really a true gambler. I had another friend of mine in Vegas actually, and there were a couple busts or stings where they arrested a lot of people. And I don't know if you've heard about these, but they had some clip joints in Vegas too. And the taxi drivers would take these people to tourists. They would get a kickback of $100 to $200, I think, for taking them to these relaxation spas here in Vegas. And what they would do is that they would, you know, kind of entice them with the, you know, the prospect of sex, but never really paying it. And then they would just take as much money from them as possible and then kick them out on the street. And one of my friends, he, you know, after a late night, he was drinking and playing, And he said, you know, the cab driver's like, hey, you know, he's like, well, you want to have some fun? You want to get some girls? He said, sure, you know, whatever. Okay, why not? And so they take him to this club or the spa. He goes in and it's like $100, okay, for a massage for 1 hour. He's like, okay, great. It changes, whatever. And he goes, lays on the table, and they start massaging. A very beautiful girl comes in, and she starts giving him a massage. And, you know, he's enjoying it. Goes on for about 5-10 minutes. And she says, hey, she says, would you like the special massage? And he's like, well, absolutely. That's why I'm here. And so he says, okay, but we got to go to this different room. Also, it's going to be it's an extra $200 for the special massage. And he's like, well, he's like, I really don't know, but he's like, ah, this girl's very beautiful. So, okay. So they whatever. He pays her. They go to a second room. A second room. She goes, okay. You know, lays face down, whatever. And she starts massaging his feet. Okay. And he's like, okay. He's like, what gives? And she's like, oh, this is a special massage. And he says, wait. He says, that's not what I thought. And he's like, I thought, you know, something good was going to happen, you know. And she's like, oh, you want the secret massage. He's like, yeah. He's like, obviously. He's like, okay, well, that's $300. We got to do it in a different room. And he's like, oh. But he's like, okay, but it's going to be a good massage, right? And she's like, oh, yeah, it's the best. You'll leave here very happy. So he says, okay. So he puts on $300. They move to a third room now. So he lays face down on the table, and the woman puts on latex gloves and starts massaging his back again, very lightly. And he says, well, what the hell is this? He says, and she's like, well, this is the secret massage. You know, if you want the whatever, it's going to be. And he's like, no. He's like, I'm leaving. He's like, yeah, he's like, I don't, whatever. He's like, I want my money back. And so, you know, he's like, he's pissed. He gets up, he leaves. He's putting on his clothes, and he's like, he's arguing with the spa owner or whatever. And they are like, oh, no, that's what you paid for. He's like, you got your services. He's like, why don't you sit down and finish your massage? And, you know, obviously it's all a scam. And so he's out $700 at this point, and he's furious. So what he does is when in the spa area, when you lock up your clothes, they actually give you like a little padlock. Okay. And so he took the padlock, and as he was leaving, he threw the padlock through the plate glass window of the front of the store, and it just smashes the glass window. Very expensive window, I'm sure. And two real big guys come out, and they start chasing him, and they just have a foot chase down like Flamingo or wherever it was, you know, and they chased him for quite a while, and he got away. And
wow. You know, there was a famous clip joint right on the strip next to Casino Royale. Yeah. That was the lobster place. Yeah. And they have these pictures of these giant lobsters. And you would go in and the menu would just say market price or whatever. I don't know if it's still there. It might be.
That same guy was holding a big lobster for decades. He never aged at all.
Right. But then you would get the bill and it'd be $300 or $400 or whatever for the lobster.
Yeah. There was actually, I think at one of them here, there was a British tourist he was stabbed and almost killed after getting in an argument with those people. Maybe not at that one, but at a different one. And that was a few years back. So it is really dangerous, you know, to go to those places, like never get the best of them. And you just have to be extremely careful. I wouldn't trust any cab driver, you know.
I think that lobster place you're talking about must have, when they built Encore, because it was at the corner of where next to the Venetian, between the Venetian and Spring Mountain. And so when they...
No, it's the other way. It was...
Palazzo, right? I mean...
It was between the Venetian and the Casino Royale. Because originally it was right next to the Sands before they tore the Sands down. But.
Okay. And I said Encore, I meant Palazzo. I apologize. All right. You mentioned last week that you had a big mouth. Did your mouth ever get you into any trouble?
Well, when I was playing online, I think that it's really common, you know, after you win a hand or, you know, you develop, I don't know, strong feelings towards some of the players you're playing with. You know, if someone beats you in a lot of pots, you say, this guy's an idiot. And, you know, you might just type that or whatever, say, hey, you're really a moron, how you're so lucky. And, you know, similarly, you might gloat a little bit, especially if you beat someone in a lot of pots and you know he's a pro. If you know he's a recreational player, well, just whatever. But just give him a hard time. You know, make them dislike you a little bit. And so when I came to play live poker, I kind of had that same attitude, you know, because it's a chat box. Or a casino, no one's going to do anything to you. There's cameras everywhere. And I had one situation where I was at Turning Stone, and I think I was 19, and I was just playing some limit hold'em there. And, you know, I'm just being my usual, just real annoying self at that time. Just, you know, winning hands and, you know, making comments like, you're just, you know, you're bad, or I knew what you had. Just really nonsense stuff. And in my mind, I was thinking, okay, you know, they're going to play worse against me, and, you know, I'm going to, you know, I'll profit. So after beating this one guy, he really didn't take it well, and a real big Indian guy, part of the tribe, I think. And he's like, okay, he said, the next person who beats me in a pot is going to get knocked out. He says, I'm going to knock that guy out. And he storms off and leaves. Okay. And I'm still playing there. And I say, oh, that guy, well, what a meathead. You know, he can't be serious. Right. And someone says, hey, he says, that guy boxed in the Olympics. So I wouldn't take what he says lightly. And I was like, oh, no, whatever. Anyways, so I actually I get up at some point to go to dinner, come back, and there's a rail, and there's security guards everywhere, and like my chips are like all knocked over, and there's like a bunch of people staring and watching, and the guy, that Indian guy, and the guy on my right are gone. And I say, well, what happened? And he said, that guy's not a liar. So that guy beat him. In the guy on your right beat him in a pot with a flush draw or something, and he stood up and just punched him in the face, and they got into a big brawl. Other guy was, you know, 250 pounds as well. They just got into a big brawl, you know, two of the local tribe guys, and they said they were kicked out for one day. So so I guess it must have happened often. And, you know, I was thinking, well, you know, I was a pretty skinny guy. That guy had hit me, probably would have killed me. So after that, I said, you know, I think that maybe I should be more careful about what I say. And I think a lot of times, too, it's very heated. People don't like to lose to like a young punk, you could say. So even if I wasn't doing anything, I would constantly get death threats, you know, say, hey, said, I'm going to kill you. Said, why don't you meet me in the parking lot? I've got a knife. I was like, it's like really explicit death threats at the table, just in front of everyone. And I'd be like, okay, well, you can see here, I'm playing here, but if you want to, you know, kill me, then you're going to have to wait till you're out of money. And then you're going to have to wait for me to finish cashing out and stuff like that. And I would say that stuff too. And that's, you know, obviously that's not what someone wants to hear, that they're, you know, they're going to go broke and they're going to have to wait for you. And it just, I got into a couple situations where, I really thought that I might have been in some danger, but at the same time, you know, I don't know. It didn't really occur to me. Now, looking back, I was a real idiot.
Yeah, especially in the LA card rooms, there are some really not nice people playing in those games. You know, and some dangerous people playing in those games.
I had a friend of mine, and he was playing, and there was a very complicated situation with the guy who was he was kind of a gang connected or whatever. Anyways, it's like they had maybe like a slight friendship, and then the guy he played his chips a little bit when he was not there. It became a big deal, and then the guy wanted some money from him. So when he was at home one day, he got a call from that guy, and he said the guy said, "Hey, it's like, does your girlfriend have a white dog?" And he's like, yeah. He's like, she does. And he said, oh, well, he's like, I see her walking down the street right now with her dog. It'd be a real shame if someone cut that dog's head off, and also cut her head off too. She's real cute. And he's like, what? And he's just terrified. And he's like, okay. He's like, I was just letting you know that. I was like, that. He's like, that would be terrible. Anyways, the guy had wanted some money, and I guess he ended up loaning him the money. So, you know, you just have to be very careful when you interact with these people, because, you know, they may feel that you owe them something, or they, you know, and they may try to collect on that. And, you know, the way that they collect might not be a certified letter at your door. So,
yeah. And there was a number of years ago, there was a big problem in LA with follow home robberies. They'd follow people out of the casino, and there were a number of murders where they would follow someone home, kill them, and take the money that they.
Absolutely. And it's just really terrifying. You know, it's like you win And then you got to get lucky just to make it home in one piece. So I would really recommend. They have players' banks at all those casinos. I've heard stories where, you know, a woman gets a bad beat jackpot, takes it all in cash because, you know, she's not American. You know, she's just in, if you were in Asia or something, you take all that money home and, you know, you wouldn't keep it at the casino. It's safer at your house. And, you know, someone will come by and either follow her home or be waiting in the parking lot, just, you know, stuff her into her trunk and take the money. And it's terrible.
We're doing this interview nearing the end of the World Series of Poker. Did you play this year? And if so, how'd you do?
I haven't played yet. I was thinking about maybe stopping in for just a little bit. But I really think that the games are a lot tougher and the players are a lot sharper. You could say that a lot of the pros, they've been at this for 10 years, and they've learned online. So not like in the past where you'd have these live pros and, you know, it's just the chances that you were playing very high stakes was partially based on skill, but a lot of it was based on luck because, you know, it takes a great deal of luck to be able to play the highest stakes because you're not playing many hands per hour. So just to get the bankroll, get the money to be able to play it is difficult. But I really have not played much. And I think for anyone coming up in the ranks, when I go online and look, and I have some friends who still play, and I'll watch them play and give them some advice. But I see a lot of the players that I used to play at, you know, at a 5,000 buy-in game, and they're playing, you know, a $200 buy-in game, and they're just, you know, they're great players. And, you know, when I think, okay, I got to play against a table full of these guys, it's, you know, and maybe if I'm lucky, I might win 100, 200 bucks. It just, you know, it doesn't sound very appealing to me. You know, I prefer to maybe buy some action of some of my friends in one of the tournaments and hope that, you know, maybe they get lucky or something. And, you know, I just don't have the stamina to sit there for 40 hours and, you know, pay attention to every single thing while, you know, while playing and sleeping, you know, 6 hours a night. It's really exhausting. Anyone who says that it isn't is probably... they're probably listening to music. They're probably reading their iPod, you know, and it's, you give up a lot of the value by not paying 100% attention to the other players, not having sound, you know.
You're not playing much poker at all anymore. Is that why you've kind of tapered off from it?
Yeah, I think so. It's just, I would evaluate it in terms of, you know, how much your expectation is. And I think that, especially in, you know, the U.S., there's just a ton of, you know, really good players. So unless you're playing, you know, somewhere where, you know, there's a lot of recreational players and it's not as serious, then it's going to be difficult to, you know, have a really, really high win rate. I'm a little spoiled too because, you know, I played online. You could wake up, play 12 hours in your boxers and, you know, eat pizza while doing it. And, you know, now it's, you go to the casino and there's a list and then some guy tipped more. So he gets moved to the front and, you know, you just sit there for 4 hours and go home and never play a hand. That's tough.
You can still wear boxers though, but Jeff put something over the top. there's a lot of famous poker players who, they've had TV time. So you won some big tournaments. So you think they're doing well, but apparently they're not doing, they owe everybody money.
Are they all winning players or
so something that in there that's a cognitive dissonance? So what's going on?
Well, I think that, and this isn't as true as much now as it was maybe 5 years ago, but there used to be tournaments, $10,000 tournaments at, you know, in every stop in the globe. Anywhere you go, you could find a $10,000, you know, dollar tournament in, you know, just wherever, you know, you can go to Tunica, Mississippi, or you go to Maine, just random $10,000. And so it's very expensive to travel the circuit, and you have your flight, your expenses, your hotel room for 7 days, and, you know, your flight out, and you're buying it all last minute because you don't know if you're going to be there for, you know, one day, bust out, or be there for 7 days. And it just, it really adds up. So a $10,000 tournament is not a $10,000 investment. It's a $20,000, $30,000 investment. And, you know, of course, poker players, they like to do everything big. So they're not staying in the Motel 6, and they're not walking to the casino, and they're not, you know, eating at the value meal at McDonald's. So, because of that, a lot of these guys that, you know, have that were very, very successful, for each one of them, there is three guys who were just barely getting by, you know, scraping by from, you know, cash to cash, really on the kind of like the edge of going broke. And so a lot of them turned up, they got staked, they were backed by players, and, you know, that would pay for a lot of their expenses. And it seemed like a lot of these guys who, if you make $1 million, $2 million in one tournament, then all of a sudden you're thinking, okay, well, that's how it's going to be. You know, that's poker. And you see that there are players who have multiple $1 million tournament scores, but I think the reality is a lot more dark than that. It's just most people don't ever make their, they don't reach the long run. They don't make even their money back after expenses, much less show a healthy profit. So the winners would subsidize the losers by staking a lot of them. And there were a few stables in the poker community. And it just seemed like whenever anyone got staked, and, you know, I've had a lot of friends who have been staked, they would just kind of lose their mind and say, okay, well, you know, I'm working for the man, and, you know, I'm just going to play. And I won't play 100% best poker, but I'll play some good poker. And I'm such a great player that it doesn't even matter. My 50% is still, you know, great. And, you know, I've been with friends, and, you know, say it's like 6 o'clock on like a Saturday or something, or a Sunday, and they say, hey, let's go out, let's get some food. And they would say, well, I'm in these tournaments, but yeah, you're right, I'm hungry too. So I gotta bust out of all these tournaments. That's what they'd say every time. I gotta bust out of these tournaments. And so they immediately start looking for a spot and say, well, you know, I have to send my back or all my hands where I bust. So I'm immediately going to start looking for a spot where I can get it in. So you have ace king or something, and they're like, okay, this is a good one. And you could be like all in, all in, all in. And, you know, you've got ace king or pocket eights. And, you know, they say, okay, well, I'm going to write them a message saying these guys are all playing real aggressive. And so, okay, I'm all in. You know, it's like, okay, aces, kings, and then like two other ace kings or something stupid. Just, and he's like, okay, great. He's like, let's see if we can go. And that was kind of the attitude for a lot of these stables. And I don't think that people that were staking them actually realized, I don't know what you call it, a moral hazard.
I don't understand how they can stake guys with a 50% share anyway. I mean, that's insanity.
Right?
Right?
Absolutely. They moved away from that a lot, but you know, a lot of them would end up getting really favorable deals. And they play with makeup. So, you know, the idea is you're committed to playing for a year or 2 years, and so in the end, the long run, that you'll show a profit and you guys will split it. But the reality is that, you know, someone gets 100,000-200,000 in makeup, well, they don't no longer want to play anymore. If I'm not going to play a tournament where I can win 200,000, if my makeup is 200,000, if I get first place, I get zero. So, you know, those kind of arrangements are just, they're not really good for the player, and they're not really good for the backer. Well, actually, I guess they're very good for the player, because they end up either, you know, doing this very high variance stuff where they end up winning a bunch and then cash out and go on their own, or they, as you know, they get in debt a lot and then leave. But, you know, that's bad for their reputation too. So there's a lot of ways to structure a stake or whatever. But, you know, as for me, I prefer taking action of my friends. You know, if I'll buy a piece of them and they sell it with some markup or something. And then, you know, if it's just a one-off thing, you know, if they play the main event, then maybe I get, you know, buy 10%, and I pay a little vig for that premium for their time. And that's just a lot better, because, you know, then they're playing their own money, and, you know, they're not going to say, oh, I'm tired of playing, let's try to make it look good.
Thank you, Tony. I am very glad you didn't get bumped off back when you had a big mouth, because that means Richard and I would have needed a guest 2 weeks in a row. So glad to have you. Thank you. Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.